Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 28, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a Courthouse Steps oral argument discussion on Timms v. Indiana. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are very fortunate to have with us Darpana Sheth, who is a senior attorney with the Institute for Justice, which represents Tyson Timms, and she is the director of IJ's National Initiative to End Forfeiture Abuse. After our speaker gives her remarks today, we will move to an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for our speaker today or for the case in general. Thank you for sharing with us today, Darpana. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, so the case is Tyson Timms versus State of Indiana, and the issue before the court is, can a state impose any fine, no matter how excessive? So for constitutional scholars out there and those familiar with the Eighth Amendment has a prohibition against excessive fines, which is, of course, applied to the federal government since 1791. And the question before the Supreme Court is whether that prohibition also applies to the state. Now, most people would have thought, of course it does. There's a doctrine of incorporation, and most of our Bill of Rights have been incorporated against the states. But this was one clause which the Supreme Court had not expressly held, the prohibition against excessive fines. One is incorporated against the states, or therefore applied to the states. And so really the case is kind of a matter of constitutional housekeeping. Involved is our client, Tyson Timms. He pled guilty to selling less than $400 worth of drugs. And the state trial court found that requiring Timms to forfeit his vehicle, which was valued at $42,000, would be grossly disproportionate to his wrongdoing and would violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive fines. The Indiana Supreme Court, however, reversed. It did not address the merits, but simply held that the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against excessive fines does not apply to the state or to the local government either. And so, by implication, basically, Indiana or a state can impose any fine, no matter how excessive or disproportionate to the offense. In the case, Tyson Timms prescribed opioids initially for foot pain, and in an unfortunate kind of all too familiar tale these days of opioid addiction, Timms had turned to heroin when his prescription ran out. Eventually, he was arrested during a drug sting, and he pleaded guilty and was sentenced to six years, one in home detention, living with his aunt, and then 5 years on probation, including a court-supervised addiction treatment program. The court also imposed more than $1,200 in criminal court costs and fees. But going beyond this criminal prosecution, state prosecutors sought to civilly forfeit his vehicle. Now, the government theory was it wasn't that the vehicle was used to transport drugs. So there was no question that the vehicle was bought legally. It was purchased with legal proceeds from a life insurance policy after his father's death. But prosecutors sought to take the vehicle because Timms had driven it to transport drugs. And the justices today kind of zeroed in on that in terms of, well, what if it wasn't a $42,000 vehicle? What if it was a much cheaper old Kia? Or what if it was more expensive Bugatti? And so that was very much an issue today, sort of the excessiveness of the fine or of the forfeiture and how that excessiveness determination is calculated, what factors go into that. But at today's oral argument, I think we're very optimistic that a majority of the justices thought that the excessive fines clause itself certainly applies to the states and to local governments. And perhaps most tellingly, Justice Gorsuch, about just less than a sentence in to argument from the Solicitor General of Indiana, said, you know, stopped them right there and interrupted and asked, you know, well, we can all agree that the excessive fines clause is incorporated against the state. Isn't that correct? And there was some back and forth, but Justice Gorsuch continued and questioned, said, you know, here we are in 2018, are we still litigating the incorporation of the Bill of Rights? Really? And I think that was a really telling moment today of which way the court is going to rule. For the on the side of the states, the Solicitor General, their main position is that in rem forfeitures, so the civil forfeitures, which are, you know, based on a legal fiction that property itself is guilty, and consequently these actions are brought against property, not a person, that those somehow do not qualify as fines, that they are not punitive in some method, and therefore the real issue before the court is not whether the excessive fines clause applies to the state, but whether there is a right to be free from excessive in rem forfeitures that applies to the state. And I think it's a fair reading of the justices today that they rejected that kind of analysis, but that is not what we've done historically in analyzing the Bill of Rights and whether those rights apply to states, that there's first a question of whether a right is incorporated, and secondly, there's the sort of definition of that right or the scope of that right. And so whether the excessive fines clause itself is incorporated against the state, it seems like the majority of the justices agree, and there might be some tension about whether the specific, whether an in rem forfeiture, so a forfeiture against property, qualifies as a fine. But most importantly, the Supreme Court unanimously about 25 years ago held that forfeitures like the one at issue today are in fact fines. There's a big distinction between historical civil forfeitures that were brought against property, ships, or customs violations and admiralty laws. And today's modern in rem forfeitures, back then it was a tool to obtain jurisdiction over property because the wrongdoer and the commission of the crime was overseas or there was no personal jurisdiction. Whereas in contrast today, most of all forfeitures are done pursued against property owners where the property owner is under the jurisdiction of the court. And crucially here in Indiana, the statute itself recognizes that the forfeiture is in part a punitive measure. And therefore, because it's at least partially punitive, the excessive fines clause should apply because it's part and parcel of the entire Eighth Amendment, which is purpose is to curb excessive punishment. So whether there's three different clauses of the Eighth Amendment, we have the excessive fines clause, we have the prohibition against excessive bail, and then of course the cruel and unusual punishment clause, or ban on cruel and unusual punishment. And all three, the Supreme Court has noted at least on five other occasions that the Eighth Amendment applies to the state. And so really this case boils down to a little bit of constitutional housekeeping to clarify that the excessive fines clause also applies to the state. There was also an interesting exchange today at oral argument where Justice Breyer asked whether, given the Solicitor General's opinion that in rem forfeitures or forfeitures brought directly against the property, civil forfeitures, if they are not excessive fines or they can never be excessive fines, whether a state would be allowed to forfeit a car simply for a violation of speeding violation, even if the car was only going 5 miles above the speed limit. And the Solicitor General responded in the affirmative, saying yes, that could happen. And it seems like a majority of justices do not agree with that approach. So we are cautiously optimistic. And the significance of this case is that, you know, it goes beyond just forfeitures. Increasingly, states and localities are using fines, fees, and forfeitures to essentially fund the criminal justice system. And there have been a number of amici in support of him that showed, that really lay out some of the statistics of how increasingly the government is using fines and fees and forfeitures to fund criminal justice. And because of that, the power of the government to impose fines should be viewed more skeptically, because unlike terms of imprisonment or other forms of punishment, the government can actually benefit from fines, fees, and forfeitures. They are a revenue-generating mechanism as opposed to forms of punishment that cost the government money. And so a favorable ruling in this case would go a long way towards limiting state power to impose excessive fines, fees, and forfeitures. So I think, as I said, we're cautiously optimistic about a favorable ruling, and we look forward to getting a decision from the court.
Thank you very much, Darpana, for your remarks. While we wait for any questions from the audience, Darpana, I know you've touched on this, but could you spell out a little bit more for us what way you think this case will go and your reasoning there?
Yeah, I think on the issue of whether the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against excessive fines applies to the state, we think certainly a majority of the justices seem to agree with that today. There might be some tension or questions about whether the forfeiture, particularly in this case, was excessive or not. But that's a decision the court can address on remand. And of course, it's important to note that the state trial court looked at that, answered that actual question, and ruled that here, requiring him to forfeit a $42,000 vehicle when he sold less than $400 worth of drugs, and where the maximum fine was only $10,000, would be grossly disproportionate and therefore violate the Eighth Amendment.
Thank you so much. Looks like we do have two questions in the queue, Darpana. Let's go ahead and move to our first caller.
Well, good afternoon. I'm just curious, if you are successful in this case and get the ruling that you are expecting, what's your next step in the process of dealing with forfeitures?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. We're hoping that this is just the first in a series of cases that the Supreme Court will take up to really examine the constitutionality of civil forfeiture itself. Recently, Justice Thomas had questioned whether modern civil forfeiture statutes can really be squared with the Due Process Clause or our nation's history, and kind of focused in on this distinction between the way civil forfeiture was practiced back at the time of our founding and the very limited justification and scope of civil forfeiture at that time compared to today's exponential kind of expansion, where there is this very direct financial incentive that law enforcement have in pursuing forfeiture. It forms a lot of law enforcement budget. And that kind of direct financial incentive really poses a due process problem. So there are a number of other constitutional issues with civil forfeiture, far beyond just whether a particular forfeiture can be excessive. And we're hoping that the Supreme Court will take a look at those issues closely. And we're bringing those cases in the lower court today and hoping they move up pretty quickly.
Thank you very much, caller. Do have one more question in the queue. Let's go ahead and move to our second caller.
Yes, thank you. Two elements seem to be important to me. One has to do with what the Indiana Constitution may say with respect to forfeiture, whether or not it intrudes on a decision that the Supreme Court may be facing. And the other thing that I find puzzling, the Eighth Amendment is one sentence long and includes the issue having to do with cruel and unusual punishments, which clearly apply to the states. And yet a second part of that same sentence might not strike me as being unusual.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of the second part of your question. The Eighth Amendment it does have three separate provisions, guarantees. One is the guarantee that excessive bail shall not be required. The second is that excessive fines should not be imposed. And the last one is that there should be no cruel and unusual punishment. And so the Supreme Court has already held that the excessive bail and the cruel and unusual punishment clauses apply to the state. And they have implied in at least five other cases that the excessive fines clause also applies to the state. In this case, it's basically clarifying that holding that the Eighth Amendment guarantees that excessive fines should not be imposed, and that is not just applicable to the federal government, but also to the state government. Did that answer the second question?
Well, you seem to be saying that even though there are three elements dealt with in that one sentence, that they seem to feel free to separate them with regard to interpretation.
Oh, right. And so I think there's different analysis for each constitutional amendment. So, for example, the Fourth Amendment does not just embody one right. There are several rights at issue that the Fourth Amendment protects. And so the Supreme Court has analyzed those rights separately in separate cases. Here, in this case, the right at issue is the right to be free from excessive fines. And what the state of Indiana's position is, no, we need to thin slice that even further. It's not just the right to be free from excessive fines. It's the right to be free from excessive civil forfeitures, which is, as the Supreme Court has unanimously ruled before, forfeitures qualify as a fine. And so that is the part that, you know, the Institute for Justice has strongly disagreed with, and I think the majority of the justices did not find that convincing. Justice Kagan today explained that, you know, she wasn't really sure. When the history of incorporation is looking at the right at issue, and, you know, whether it's the Second Amendment right to bear arms or the right to free speech in the First Amendment, we don't thin slice it and say, well, no, there's a right to political speech or there's a right to commercial speech. We look at the right to free speech. And so that we don't just incorporate the First Amendment in total. We look at the specific clause. So, of course, the First Amendment has, you know, five other rights as well, or five rights that are protected. So it's a matter of selectively incorporating each right at issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Looks like we do have another question. Let's go ahead and move to that caller.
Good afternoon. Kent Huntington, Huntington Solutions. I have a question, which actually springs not from this, well, part of this appeal, but your biography notes that the Eighth Amendment comes into action in 1791. I was wondering if you could give some historical context about its underpinnings from 1776 to 1791, and indeed anything prior to that, including the British law, which we were operating under until 1776. And it's just an open question of historical context that's interest to me and some others.
Sure. So we'll direct you to our merits brief, because that'll have all of the specifics. And you can find that on our website, ij.org, under Tim's versus Indiana. But the short answer is that, yes, I mean, one of the things that the court looks at in deciding whether a specific right in the Bill of Rights is applies to the state is whether it's been deeply rooted in our nation's history and whether it's a fundamental. And our merits brief in this case has gone through the history of both the Eighth Amendment, the Excessive Fines Clause, as well as the 14th Amendment, and shown that over time, dating all the way back to like the 13th century, there was a historical protection of against excessive fines, whether that was from against the king, people hunting in the king's forest, and then they were fined for overhunting, I guess, in some way, or hunting animals illegally in the king's forest, till today's time, or even in the 14th Amendment was adopted. And so our brief goes through all of that history, and including the Magna Carta and various protections, and shows that this is deeply rooted, because ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, that the power to fine is a unique kind of power that the
sovereign has that can easily be subjected to abuse, because unlike other forms of punishment, it generates revenue for the government as opposed to costing the government money.
Excellent. I guess my follow-up would be, how is this interplay, the Eighth Amendment rights, with the historical roots of, you know, our country's founding and you know, prohibitions against bills of attainder, ex post facto laws, and you know, what we're seeing today in the abuses of the administrative state, and what you're doing, I guess, finally about at IJ to push back on this in the broader context apart from the Eighth Amendment. Thank you.
Sure. So, as I mentioned earlier, I think, you know, we're hoping that this case is just one in a series of cases that the Supreme Court will take on to address the inherent unconstitutionality of civil forfeiture. No one in America should lose their property without being convicted of a crime, and civil forfeiture has a number of due process problems. You know, there's a lack of an innocent owner defense in some cases, even when states have an innocent owner defense that puts the burden on property owners to affirmatively prove their innocence, which is a due process problem that the Supreme Court identified in a separate case called Nelson versus Colorado, involving the return of fines assessed against criminal defendants when their convictions have been overturned. And of course, there's the direct financial incentive that police and prosecutors have in bringing civil forfeitures. And that poses a due process problem as well. And so we're hoping that the Supreme Court will directly take on a case that directly challenges the constitutionality of civil forfeiture, not just the Eighth Amendment kind of limitations that governments have in using forfeiture.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, caller. Seeing no immediate questions, Darpana, I turn the mic back to you. Do you have any closing thoughts for us today?
Yes, well, we're excited to, you know, when we get a decision. And like I said, the significance of this case is goes beyond just civil forfeitures, because increasingly states and localities are using fines and fees and other mechanisms to extract money from its citizens in order to fund itself. And this will be an important limitation against the state government power to do so.
Well, thank you so much, Darpana. It does look like we do have an audience member that slipped in with a question. Let's get to theirs before we close today. Let's go ahead and move to our another caller.
Hi, this is Mark Allen, Trinity Law School. I have a quick question for you. Do you have any idea what to do about the situation that I see all the time, which is sheriff's office goes in, they empty people's cars out, and then they just refuse to give the stuff back. There's no civil forfeiture action, there's no court action, they simply just don't give it back. And most of these things are small, you know, way less than $1,000. Tim's case, I think, was like $42,000. So that makes it worthwhile for somebody to go after. But what do we do about all these like little thefts that police departments and sheriff's departments are doing?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because I mean, if the economics of it make it irrational for property owners on site back to get their property back, because these are civil proceedings, even when a forfeiture is actually filed, it becomes a civil proceeding. They're not guaranteed counsel, and so they have to pay attorneys and navigate the business complicated system of trying to get their property back, which, you know, most people make that the rational decision that it's not worth doing, because hiring an attorney is going to cost way more than the property value itself. That is something that IJ is challenging directly, that because civil forfeiture kind of shift these burdens and stack the debt against property owners by shifting the burdens of proof around. That's why it's unconstitutional. At the federal level, there's one avenue called a motion for return of property, and most states and localities have something similar. 41G in the rules, federal rules of criminal procedure, that any person who's been aggrieved by a seizure can file a motion for return of property. But again, you know, that involves hiring an attorney and and trying to file one of these motions to get the property back. And so the solution is both through the courts and trying to show the unconstitutionality of civil forfeiture, and also by appealing to our legislative bodies and reforming civil forfeiture. And since 2014, 29 states and the District of Columbia have reformed their forfeiture laws to try to make these burdens a little less harsh.
Seeing that the queue is now empty, Darpana, we appreciate the remarks you've given. Any closing thoughts before we end?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And again, a favorable ruling here will really protect millions of Americans from abusive fines, fees, and forfeiture. So we look forward to the court's decision.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We're very grateful that we could host you. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.